roll call for you?
Yes, please.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone on today's PPSC PDP call on Thursday, the 14th of October. We have Jeff Newman, Alex Gakuru, Avery Doria, Paul Diaz, Wolf Knorben, Alan Greenberg. From staff, we have Marika Konings, Margie Milam, Glenn de Saint-Giry, and myself, Gisela Gruber-White. We have apologies from Tatiana Kramtsova and James Bladel. If I could please just remind everyone to state their names when speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you. Over to you, Jeff.
Thank you very much. This is Jeff Newman, chair of the PDP work team. It is, as Gisela said, October 14th. And we are making some good progress, and hopefully today will be a day that we can come close to finishing this public comment review tool. Wolf already has a question, so I'm going to go to Wolf.
Hi, together. No, it's not a question. I just would like to welcome Jeff to the council from November. Congratulations to your election, Jeff, and hopefully we have a good work together in future. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Wolf. I guess I join after the annual meeting. So Chuck is still there, Chuck and Edmund, and I look forward to joining after that meeting. Avery?
Yeah, I just wanted to add to that that I will miss seeing your email that says, since I don't have access to send this list.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to say that I'm going to miss those.
Well,
I'm
sure you'll just see the substance of those emails now as opposed to the deprecatory statements.
I'm teasing you, but it's great that you got on.
Well, thank you. I figure, you know, it's enough time from the outside criticizing. I might as well do it from the inside.
It's a lot more fun.
I'm sure. Okay, on that note, so what's just as some of you may have joined a little bit early to hear some of our pre-talk on this. The goal is to have a I know our next step in the PDP process is to actually do a final report. What we'd actually like to do, because we're not sure we can get a final report out before the Cartagena meeting, is to get the next draft out by the document deadline in Cartagena, so we could have a session to talk about those things at Cartagena with the goal of issuing a final report shortly after the Cartagena meeting. So we think there'll be enough new stuff to generate interest in commenting on the stuff that we've talked about since. And ICANN's legal staff is already working on some of the deliverables that we said we would be doing, like a draft of bylaws and draft Annex A to the bylaws and some other things. So we think we'll have a good amount of substance to put out before Cartagena to generate discussion, even though it won't be a, quote, final report. Is that anyone have any questions on that?
Just
great.
A comment, Jeff. My recollection is we had scheduled the final report well into 2011. Am I misremembering?
I think that Marika, you might be better to answer that.
I'm just wondering, did we really make up a lot of time we didn't expect to?
Yeah, this is Marika. I think the idea was indeed from the start to have a draft final report, as a number of the recommendations hadn't been decided upon yet, and also because some issues weren't discussed yet.
Okay.
I think the question is a bit like how draft final is this report that we can put out by Cartagena? Will we manage to get through all the overarching issues and have recommendations on all the items that we feel comfortable that this is really the draft final report that we're putting out for public comment, or whether, you know, we'll have a first discussion in Cartagena, but we'll still need to do more work and still rework some of the recommendations that might need further community consideration before we really call it final, and are happy to push it ahead to the PPSC.
Okay.
Right. Okay, thank you for the clarification. So what we'll spend the rest of the day doing, or the rest of our time now doing, is going through the public comment review tool. We are getting close to the end. We are on the overarching issues, which is on page 36 of 39. And just as a reminder, we'll go through this, and then we'll go through some of Mary's comments, or actually I should say Mary's comments that were endorsed by the non-commercial stakeholder group. We'll go through some of those comments that we may not have covered in previously. And then after that, we will get back to you next week as to we're going to do a basically inventory of the issues that we still have, basically, that we're left for, you know, still to discuss. So we will pick up on that starting next week. Also today, we're going to keep the call to an hour, which is another 50 minutes. And I know that won't disappoint most of you, but I think last week we did a good job of keeping it down to an hour, and I think people got less fatigued by the hour. So we'll try to keep this one to an hour as well. Any objections to that? All right, I didn't think so. So going to page 36 of the public comment review tool, in the overarching issues section, the first comment was from the, or a bunch of comments were from the International Trademark Association, and the first issue, the first comment they made is without firm recommendations, or in some cases any roadmap suggesting the direction of the work team's discussions to date on a particular overarching issue is difficult for them to comment. I totally understand that. They hope that the public will have another opportunity to comment, and so I think that's something we were planning on anyway. We realized that we were just hoping on some of these issues to get more brainstorming and ideas. So jumping on to a specific issue, the first one is on timing. They agree that an overall assessment of timing needs to be conducted. They hope that the public will have a further opportunity to comment. Okay. So there's really not much. So one of the issues we'll need to put on the agenda starting next week is on timing and putting everything together. We've had some discussions on individual elements, but we haven't looked at it from a holistic standpoint. And Marika, help refresh my memory. We did not do, in the charts that we did for the report, did we do a kind of timeline as to, did we do like a draft straw man as far as timing? I know we did the steps, but we didn't really put any kind of timing in there, right?
And this is Marika. No, we didn't. And if you look at the different recommendations that we've made, I think so far the only thing we've identified as for timing is like minimum time frames for public comment periods. It looks like for most of the others, we've talked about maybe having the issues report, a proposed timeline for the PDP or the charter. But I guess in the end, it might be a challenge to actually do a timeline because we're allowing for much more flexibility in the model we're looking at now, depending on the issue and the outline. So we haven't had much discussion whether we want to set maximum time frames for anything, but I don't think, on any of the issues so far, there has been support for that.
So I think we've done some things like saying that once a initial report comes out or certain reports come out in the process that we take a minimum of X number of days of public comment period. We've also said things that when the report is delivered to the council within X number of days prior to the council meeting, there are some indications of timing, even if not, a concrete number of days, but it was like, we think the council should address it at their next meeting, even if they decide to table it for one meeting. It would be nice if we could just lay out some of those things where they're listed, even if it's not in a concrete number, but more like, X plus 30 days or something like that.
Right, and what we might do as well for those phases where we are not defining a time, we might indicate, like, to be defined in the charter or to be defined in the issues report to indicate, in which context that is defined, and it's not a kind of open-ended, or it's not the intention of having open-ended, working groups and developments of issues report, but the timing is normally decided either, between staff and the council or as part of the charter discussions as such.
Right, and maybe we can make up some sort of fake scenario which this group may be able to agree on, what something like that would look like as kind of just an example, but not just an illustration as opposed to a firm example. Because what we don't want people to come out of this believing is that these are, you know, we started on the one end of the pendulum, if you will, with having time periods that are completely unrealistic and too fast, but we don't want to lead people to believe the other side of the pendulum is what we're recommending, meaning that it's completely, as you said, completely open-ended, and every PDP will now take 5-6 years. You know, that's not the intention either. Marika, you have your hand raised?
Yeah, this is Marika, because something that might be helpful in that context. I did develop some time ago basically a table that compares the different PDPs in the different stages, and from there try to abstract a bit what the average time frame is, for example, to get to an initial report and get to a final report, taking into account that, you know, some groups move faster and others move slower. So those time frames might provide some indication if the group indeed wants to give a kind of overview of what a typical PDP might look like.
Yeah, let's take a look at those averages. Some of those averages are kind of scary because some of the groups went way over the timing, and other groups were kind of much more, I would say, realistic in terms of what our goal should be for PDPs. But there were some groups that were just, you know, years in the making. And so, yeah, I agree that that'll be a helpful discussion and a helpful illustration. Alan?
Yeah, your observation is true, but PDPs come in a lot of different flavors. And comparing the PDP and UGTLDs to the domain tasting one, for instance, you're going to see radically different times and efforts into those. But that had a lot to do with the environment they were working in, what the problem was, and the possibility for easy solutions or relatively easy solutions.
Right.
You can't take all these out of context.
Exactly, and I agree with that, which is why averages are kind of scary, whereas if you just post a couple of illustrations and the context as opposed to just doing like a straight average, that might be better. Okay, so any other comments on the timing? So that's kind of one we'll have to push off a little bit. On translation, on the next item, we did have some more concrete concrete recommendations, which is essentially going back to the report. And Marika, do you recall where in the report we talk about this? But I do remember that we certainly had recommendations about doing executive summaries in the I'll call it the ICANN languages, but there's a better, more appropriate term. Is it the UN languages or what is the term that ICANN uses?
Correct. I think it's the five UN languages that we use. It's in Chapter 8, page 116.
Okay. So we do have a recommendation about that. We have recommendations about making sure that the executive summary includes things like the overall recommendations that the group is making to make sure that that's translated. We have some discussion in there about, if I'm recalling correctly, about whether public comment period, whether public comments that we get back should be translated. And so, Alan, you have a comment?
Yeah, your reference to the executive summary troubles me just a little bit based on a discussion that's been going on the council list, where Bruce had made the comment a week or so ago that what the board expects is executive summaries that are a page long. Not much more, and you know, if the executive summary doesn't do it, then staff will do it for them. You know, we're going back to the issue of what does the staff report look like. So I think we may just want to be careful on the words. I tend to agree that executive summaries or something needs to be very short and concise, which may not have room for all of the recommendations and things like that in it. So it may not be the executive summary we translate. It may be, you know, we seem to be drifting towards getting three things: the report itself, a summary of the report, and then the one pager. And maybe we need new nomenclature.
But yeah,
we want to make sure that it's not the one pager we're talking about. If the executive summary becomes really curt, then we need something else in between the two.
Yeah, so I think that's really important and a good comment, and it's kind of why I started out by saying the executive summary and the recommendations, because the recommendations themselves may not all be in the executive summary.
Okay.
But I do think you're right. We do need to spell that out. For example, in the initial report, we said that the work team agreed that the following elements must be translated: the charter, the executive summary of the initial final other report, and that public comments must be received in other languages where feasible. We said that the work team agreed that policy recommendations should be translated, and we agreed to discuss at its next meeting the potential impact of translation on timing, especially in relation to the public comment period. And in relation to the issue of how to ensure doing the translation will not slow down the PDP process, the work team discussed the different options, such as waiting until all translations are available before releasing the documents, and opening the public comment period, extending public comment periods to other languages if translated documents become available later, or shorten public comment periods in other languages than English to allow time to translate comments back in English. The work team also noted the budget implication of translations that translations have, and ICANN staff was asked to gather data on the use of any demand for translated documents to help inform the deliberations. Most members agreed that the work team should propose guidelines instead of mandatory requirements, and basically saying that the target is to make as many documents available in the five UN languages in order for people to constructively participate in the PDP process. The INCA, and I'll get to Marika in a second here, the INCA said that provisions of the new PDP related to translation should, where possible, be consistent with ICANN's translation policy. They support the idea of using volunteers to translate. However, it may support the role of a volunteer editorial group that would review professionally prepared translations to ensure the translations use technical terms correctly, and qualifications for volunteers should be outlined. Then their comment next is, further consideration should be given to how the proposed translation of key documents and public comments will impact new timelines. Fairness and inclusion dictate that non-English speakers should have the same length of time to comment, and providing translations of public comments may improve inclusiveness but may have a negative effect on the efficiency of the PDP. Marika, do you have any comments?
Yeah, this is Marika. In relation to the first comment made by the INTA and the discussions we've had, I think this is the second comment, actually. There currently is no overall ICANN policy in relation to translation. We have some principles that we've reviewed, but I'm wondering, instead of, you know, because this is an issue where we've had internal discussions, and I think it's an item that we could have as well, and then discussions on what shouldn't be, the impact, timing, cost implications, and whether it would make sense, just make a general statement that, you know, we encourage as much translation as possible, especially, you know, these kind of items, but we strongly encourage that an overall translation policy is adopted by ICANN. Because in the end, I think there are plans for doing that and having those discussions, and presumably, you know, once that gets into effect, that will apply to all the different bodies within ICANN. So I'm wondering if that's an easier or a way forward here, instead of really trying to define all the different principles and the timing and the impact, and just because I think, it, you know, as we currently look at it, it's a real impact on the budget, and it would require, for example, if we really go to translating everything, for example, a request from the GNSO to have more budget allocated to translating specifically GNSO documents. I mean, we're trying to do as much as we can with the budget we have now, but, you know, making it mandatory or, you know, really requiring it might have certain implications that will need further steps in the process. So
are you, just to clarify, are you saying that making things mandatory, like translating the executive summary and the recommendations, would be an issue, or for other things with respect to timing?
I think we're, as a practice, we're already currently doing that, especially the executive summaries. So I think that's already a standing practice, and I don't know if that will really have an impact on the budget as is. Of course, it depends as well on the number of documents we put out, et cetera, or if it would apply to any document we produce, or, you know, we're now talking, of course, only to the PDP. So I think it's partly a question as well of a consistent approach that would be helpful, I think, also for the broader community so that they know what to expect if something is published, whether it's going to be translated or not. So partly here, you know, talking and thinking at the same time, is, of course, we're now only talking about PDPs. You know, the council or the GNSO council and community produce a number of different documents as well. So there would be inconsistencies there if we make certain things mandatory here but not on the other side. So maybe strongly recommending and basically highlighting the need for an overall ICANN policy on translation to really address the issue and make sure there's a consistent approach that manages at the same time the expectations and also takes into account the budget implication that, you know, translation might or could have.
Okay. Alan?
Yeah, I find the combination of allowing the same amount of time for comments regardless of language and the possibility or the likelihood that the English language, English version will come out first, very problematic. That's happened a number of times in over the last couple of years, and it essentially presumes that someone will read a language version and comment on it and does not allow for groups which have multiple language speakers among them coming out with a joint comment. So, you know, we've had the situation in the past where the English language comments are closed on one date and the translation comments close 3 weeks later. And ALAC has taken the position that we cannot comment with our comment in English until the end of the final period because we can't get input from people within our group who are relying on the foreign language ones. So we need to make sure that the set of rules we come up with, the recommendations we come up with, are consistent and allow composite answers, composite responses to come, comments to come in, which combine multiple language input. I'm not sure if that made any sense, but...
That makes sense, and that's a good... ideal. I'm trying to think of the practical effect of what that means. Essentially, what you're saying is that the public comment period shouldn't start at all until all of the languages, all of the executive summaries, recommendations, et cetera, are translated in all of those languages.
That's one option. The other option is the comment periods not be the same length of time, but end on the same date with obviously a reasonable amount for the shortest one.
Okay. Aubrey?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. They should have an end-to-end linking and not a beginning link, you know, as in any type of scheduling exercise. So, yeah, you should schedule the end of them back from what is reasonable for the translation, but none of them should end until all of them end.
So we said in our recommendations that a minimum comment period should be a certain number of days, and I'm blanking as to what we said as far as 21 or 30. I can't remember what we said. Whatever it is, we said that the minimum should be that amount of time. Are we saying that minimum applies to each individual language? So... or are we saying that something shorter than the minimum could be for other languages?
No, I would think that if we are putting out languages because we expect comments from those speakers, those people have to have the minimum time allowed.
I agree.
Right. So essentially, what we're saying is 30 days from the last translation that comes out of the five UN languages.
If 30 days is the magic number, yes.
Yeah, I can't remember what that we said, but I was just using that as an example. So it's whatever that number of days from the date of the last translation.
I mean, there are arguments from, you know, Spanish and French speakers and Arabic speakers saying it's not fair that the English people have or English readers have more time than we do. But I think it's less fair to the community to hold back a report that's available because the translations aren't available. I don't think this is so politically charged that we need to worry about that.
Can I?
That's my opinion.
Right. Let me go quickly to Margie, and then I'll come back to you, Aubrey.
Okay.
Margie?
Sorry, I was trying to turn off my mute. I just wanted to point out that if the goal is to reduce the amount of time involved with PDPs, I mean, I know this is a tough issue, but I was thinking of something that Jeff mentioned earlier when we looked at the averages for PDPs. I had a feeling that if we were to do this with respect to the language issue, that we would dramatically increase the time that it takes to get work done through the PDP. So I just wanted to raise that we're probably going to be going in the other direction if this were to happen, because not only translating, but it takes a while. Just working with the translations department, you know, obviously rush translations are very expensive, so you have to factor in the time it takes to do the translation, and then you tack on the public comment period, and then do the comments come back in English, or they come back in the other languages, and then you got to translate that back before the work gets concluded. You're adding months to the process. So I just wanted to highlight that. I understand the issue, and I think what Marika said earlier about it being part of a bigger translation policy for ICANN is probably right, because there's a lot of operational issues related to doing something like this.
So can I ask a real quick question? And then does everyone, Margie, I think the registry agreements and registrar agreements say that English is the controlling language. Is that's right?
Yeah, I believe so, yes.
So for PDPs that are binding consensus policies, it wouldn't be that unusual for English. Like, we're putting a lot of emphasis in translations because we want comments, but in the end, it would be an English version that would control.
Yes, that would be my understanding, because there's a wide variation in quality of translations as well, and that's a big issue.
Okay. Aubrey, then back to Alan.
Okay, yeah. I understand what Alan said about the unfairness, and in fact that's one of the reasons why in a UN context they all have to come out at the same time and et cetera. However, I think there's two points that can, one is, and I don't know that emphasizing the controlling language is necessarily a good thing in the political atmosphere of ICANN, even though, yes, that remains the case, and saying because it's the control language, they get more time, saying that would be politically difficult to say. I think encouraging that the translation, that there be an attempt to get the translations out as soon or as close to the same time as the English is okay. And I think one of the reasons we can make is that, you know, we understand that so many people do have English as a second language that this does not stop its spread. But one of the other things I would suggest looking at is in all of these reports, in my experience, we tend to spend the last couple weeks, if not months, in preparing something, wordsmithing small pieces, changing sentences here and there, you know, doing careful crafting of, you know, sometimes just dithering over what a sentence should say. And I think that, and then this is again something that, you know, I've seen and experienced, you can get the bulk of a translation done and standing by waiting for the final edit. And in those cases, there doesn't need to be much of a lag, and you can shorten the elapsed time of translation. And you know, yes, I know that feeds more into what is ICANN's general translation practice and I guess policy. But here we're making recommendations on what that translation policy should be, and figuring out how to do the practice of it becomes, you know, another issue. But it makes it possible to curtail that time. So I think making recommendations that, you know, they not wait until the final is done makes it possible to do it. But I don't think we have to necessarily link ourselves to the beginning dependency, and we can make it just an ending, end-to-end dependency. Thanks.
Yeah, I think one of the issues that, and probably one of the reasons Margie and Marika raised their hand is if you do the translation before the English one is done, let's say, because the PDP work team is doing it in English, that could get much more expensive because essentially you're going to have to redo translations to reflect the final language. So that could have a pretty large budgetary impact, I would think. And let me go to Margie and Marika, and then I'll go to Alan.
Yeah, you got it, Jeff. I mean, it's a question of difficulty and cost. I mean, the translation is pretty extensive, and you're assuming that it's the same person that would be reading, that would be doing the two different documents. And I just think it's an extremely cumbersome process and costly. And also, just from my experience on the various working groups, I've seen dramatic changes between reports. And so I don't, you know, there's some cases that certainly what Aubrey mentions is correct, that there aren't a lot of changes, but there's also, I've seen, you know, a fair amount of changes so that it's essentially almost a futile effort. So I think that's not a workable solution.
Marika, and then I'll get back to Alan.
Yeah, this is Marika. I mean, just to completely agree with what Margie said and what Jeff said as well on the cost and workability of the solution. But again, because I think, you know, we're really getting bogged down in here and trying to solve the translation issue. Well, I really believe that this should be done at a higher overall ICANN level, because even, you know, addressing comments, I know there has been an issue, for example, as well in the new GDLD context. So I would really, you know, argue that it would make much more sense to, you know, just strongly recommend that, you know, this issue is moved up the priority ladder to address, to make sure that there's an overall policy, and then the group might still, you know, add a number of, you know, a wish list of things they would like to see happen in that context or what they recommend to do. But I think, you know, we could spend weeks trying to develop a policy here, which in the end, you know, might not be implementable because of budget considerations, or might be overruled once a global, you know, or an overall translation policy is adopted. So.
Yeah. So, Marika, I think with respect to some of the things, you're right. But I also think that, you know, Aubrey's come, you know, her concept of an end-to-end dependency, and I think Alan agreed with that as well. Making the strong recommendation to ICANN, you know, coming bottom up instead of top down, and making our recommendations as, look, ICANN, we'll defer to your overall effort, but please make sure you follow these general principles that for PDPs, we want to make sure that there's end-to-end consistency in public comment periods involving PDPs. I think it's kind of a helpful exercise. So I agree that some of the detail may be too much. It could take us weeks, but I think even today, just now, we've come up with a couple of principles that may be good to recommend.
Right, and Alan? I think that's absolutely right. As long as indeed in this context, we don't mandate any of these things, because I think it does require a bigger discussion also on budget implications. Because indeed, translating comments back and forth. If you look, for example, at a comment period, you know, what happened with XXX, I mean, the cost of translating that back and forth, even though many of them, you know, probably said exactly the same thing, has a serious impact. So, I think we should do this on a sensible approach and making sure as well that I think working groups there will have a good sense if certain issues might be of more interest to certain language communities and advocate in that way. And work with staff on you know, budget availability and timing and things like that. I think as we leave it flexible, I think, you know, we all know what the expectations are and wishes are.
Okay, Alan.
Yeah, the last 10 minutes has covered a fair amount of what I was going to say with people coming out of both sides of it. In terms of the step by step translation. A number of documents that I've worked on, I've been involved with recently, and they may well have been at large ones, I don't remember, have been done that way. That is, the translations have been done early, and one has to be meticulous in keeping redline versions to make sure that you can readily show the translators what has changed. but that is possible if the document is the kind that is largely written and not going to be completely rewritten from scratch. It does fall apart, however, because very often executive summaries are only written right at the end. And if it's an executive summary where only the executive summaries were translating, the whole concept does fall apart completely. But there is some experience doing this, and it does work in certain select cases anyway. I think, Jeff, you're right in that we need to put some principles in, and one of them is the one I talked about before, that one shouldn't presume that a single language version is sufficient for making comments, and therefore, you know, you have to allow the minimum time after all languages are available if we're going to get comments which represent more than a single person or a single small organization. And there are a number of principles I think we can put in that are at least give targets for whoever comes up with the formal language policies. And I don't think it's going to be a one-size-fits-all, unfortunately. Different classes of documents, I think, are going to fall into different categories. Thank you.
Oh, thanks, Evelyn. Aubrey?
Yeah, I'd like to get back to this notion that the current implementation constraints are somehow able to constrain what we're saying in what should be the policy vis-a-vis the policy development process. What we're talking about here is not just some general working group efforts. We're talking about what is the policy development process, and we're talking about the necessity for multilingualism in that policy development process. So to say that the current implementation of how it is done in ICANN presents a constraint to doing that in a way that's considered, you know, correct from a policy perspective, I think is problematic. Certainly for staff to come back to a policy recommendation that we make here saying, you know, to do that would require, you know, a budget change of X is a perfectly reasonable response from staff to sort of say, listen, from a policy perspective, we understand what you're saying, that multilingualism is something that ICANN has accepted as a policy necessity, and in the PDP, which is the most important of our policy efforts, you know, the kind of thing that gets AOC attention, et cetera, for transparency. We understand the necessity for multilingualism there. And, however, that means that, you know, we have to be able to have so much of a staff of translators, and that will have the following costs. And then people who make the policy decisions at the council level and at the board take both of those into consideration, and they decide that, no, we're not accepting the policy because it's too expensive, and let the world know that they've made a decision that multilingualism is not quite as important as something else if that's what they want to do. But for us to back down on it at this point and say, well, it might be too expensive or it might be too hard to do, especially when other people do it, and then especially if we're talking about just executive summaries, those are short. So the issue about, you know, long time lags makes a lot of sense. But so to say that, you know, it's not just a request, but it's the end-to-end dependency is mandated in our recommendation. And it's also mandated that every attempt possible should be made to have a beginning-to-beginning dependency also, unless there's good reasons not to, or some such wording. But at this point, to sort of say, you know, well, yeah, it's hard, yeah, it might cost money, therefore it should not be in the policy, I think is to give, you know, the multilingual mandate that ICANN is more and more accepting, less and to mandate it in our PDP recommendations. Makes every sense to me. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Aubrey. And I think, you know, one of the keys, there were a lot of good things in what you said, and one of the keys I think we should certainly emphasize in our report is that our recommendations, even though we kind of are deferential to the overall ICANN policy, the point that you made about, look, this is the PDP process. This may require more than what is required for other non-PDPs and other types of documents. This is such an important function of ICANN and one of its core functions that it may be more stringent than what is applied to other types of activities that ICANN has on a global basis. So to say that, you know, maybe in other circumstances, translations may not be available or there may be budgetary impact here, we may want to say in our report that this is such a core function of ICANN, recognized by the AOC, that it may have a requirements above and beyond what the general global ICANN policy is. I think that may be a helpful thing to point out in our report when we send our recommendations, that we certainly understand that not everything can undergo all of this stuff, that the budgetary impact on that would be or could be astronomical, but because this is one of ICANN's core functions, we are recommending what we're recommending. Alan?
Yeah, I agree with what both Avery and you said in your last talks. Two things I forgot to mention. One is that we already significantly disadvantage non-English speakers in the PDP process because they can't participate in the actual ongoing dialogues. Our working documents aren't in multiple languages, and our discussions don't have simultaneous interpretation. Therefore, it becomes absolutely essential that there at least be some opportunity to comment. So I don't think that's a negotiable issue, and I think we need to phrase it like that.
Alan, can I ask a question on that before
sure.
we go to the next point? Do you have any emails or something that would, I mean, for us to make that kind of statement, that sweeping statement, is there any kind of evidence that we could show of that where people have actually come forward and said, even if it's you recounting, you know, we've had several discussions in the ALAC where, you know, a number of non-native English speakers have commented on, you know, with respect to in these PDPs. Is there something you could produce that we could explain as evidence of this?
I'm sorry, I've lost you. Evidence of what? Evidence that people are disadvantaged?
Well, yeah, I mean, you made a pretty sweeping statement that you're saying non-English speakers have been or are completely disadvantaged by putting. I mean, it's a logical statement that one would assume to be true, but if there's some kind of emails or something we could point to where someone has actually complained about that fact, that would be helpful.
Well, to what extent people complain, I don't know, but it's somewhat intuitively obvious. There are plenty of French speakers and Spanish speakers and Chinese and Japanese speakers in the world who could participate, except they can't because we're doing it in English. I'm not sure we need to prove that. Maybe I'm missing something, but...
It's just helpful when statements like that are being made, because I know that there's certain people that read these reports, and if you make a general statement like that, some people...
Well, I can give evidentially proof, but it's not something that we're going to be very happy of putting in documents. Just look at the number of people... you're maybe not familiar with them, the number of people involved in ALAC, and even to a lesser extent in the GNSO, for whom English is a poor second or third language, and they typically cannot participate as well. They misunderstand things. They can't express themselves well. They can't get their ideas across as well. And they're the ones who speak English well enough to actually try to participate. So, you know, one doesn't want to go point out that X and X and X on these committees have demonstrated that they're at a disadvantage, but I think anyone who's worked in that environment recognizes it. So I'm not sure how we can prove it, but I understand what you're saying.
Because some, just to play devil's advocate, some may argue that, look, reports have been put out in other languages, and the amount of comments that those other, even when given the same amount of time to comment, the amount of comments that come back in other languages are minimal.
That's true, and you've led directly into my next point. We want to pretend or claim that we are an international organization and not restricted to English. There's a cost associated with that. And until we start doing enough documents so we attract people to be our audience, we're probably not going to see a lot of comments. We're going to need a critical mass of things done in other languages to get to the point where people notice. And I don't know what the UN budget is for interpretation and translation. It must be absolutely huge, though. And
sure.
That's going to be a cost of our doing business. And, you know, you were talking about the PDP is different from other things. It's really a core part. Well, PDPs aren't the only thing. Look at some of the public relations documents we put out. We put them out in multiple languages.
Yep.
In many cases, we release them all the same day. You know, it's viewed as important, therefore it's done. Well, from a public relations point of view, that's true, but our core business, which is setting policy, is also important. So,
yeah, I've actually...
They're simply our costs.
I agree, and it's interesting. I've taken some notice that it's interesting that a number of press releases and other things come out multiple languages on the same day when it's about, you know, something that ICANN wants to publicize.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a lot tougher to get executive summaries of policy development processes translated. It's an interesting observation. I made the same one as well. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what that says, but it probably, if ICANN staff is taking the position that translations are difficult and that these documents to translate are difficult, then maybe it should hold back.
Like everything else,
well,
it's a matter of what you think are the priorities.
Right. Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. Jeff, to correct you on the last one, we're not saying that translations are difficult. We're translating huge amount of documents. I think of all the reports we've put out over, at least since I've joined ICANN, we have translated executive summary in all the different languages. That is not the point, you know, we're trying to make here. We just want to make sure that the wider picture is taken into account and part of the discussions. On the issue of data, I mean, we did already share when we had the discussion the data that was on the different public comment periods that were held in other languages and also the download statistics on documents that were translated in other languages. So we have already shared some of that data with the group. And just, you know, on a little side note, because we had this discussion as well internally on you know, the need, the demand, the desire, budget implication, time implication. And I was actually very interested to hear that they actually specifically asked the CCNSO whether they would like to see more translated documents, you know, that being a community of different, build of different languages. And they actually said no. They didn't think that was needed. They didn't want ICANN to spend money on that, and they preferred to focus on other items, which I thought was really interesting. And also, you know, on the budget issue, yes, I know the EU, for example, they spend a huge amount of money on translation and interpretation, as well as the UN, but these are all government organizations. So, you know, in this context, I would be interested to know if there are examples of other organizations that are not funded by governments or you know, run by governments and the kind of translation policy they have, as that might be an example to look at in an ICANN context going forward. But again, we've spent almost the whole call on translation, and, you know, I think we've set out the principles, and I would just hope that we could, you know, move it on and say, look, this is really important, but it's also important to have a coherent policy and manage the expectations that others will have when it comes to translation and ICANN providing documents.
That's really key.
Yep. Okay, let me jump on then to voting thresholds. I think some of these are I'm skipping definitions because Inta just said that they want a further opportunity to comment, which is fine. Voting thresholds, the first thing the INTA said is they agree that a higher voting threshold should not apply if ICANN staff recommends initiating a PDP. I don't recall us saying that. I think what they're saying, what we said is that there's a higher threshold if ICANN staff finds that it's outside the scope. But did we ever say that? I can't remember if we actually talk about if ICANN staff says that you know, they don't want a PDP, but it's in the scope, whether it be a higher threshold. So I don't remember discussion one way or another. I think it's right that there shouldn't be a higher threshold simply because staff doesn't want a PDP unless it's outside the scope. Did we actually try to find that in the report? I'm not sure. Did we actually say that?
I don't think we said it, and I don't actually agree with it. I think staff simply saying no, there shouldn't be a PDP puts a major impediment in the road of it.
Well, but I think what we're saying is there's no formal threshold that, you know, if it's outside the scope, it's a higher threshold. We all agree with that.
Yeah.
If it's in the scope and I can't, staff just says, hey, don't waste your time on it, it wouldn't be a higher threshold.
I don't think we've recommended a higher one.
So Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. I think we did discuss it at some point, but indeed, I don't think we recommended it. I actually interpreted this recommendation as, you know, being related to the being out of scope. And I think I'm just scrolling through the notes here, you know, that we did discuss it. So maybe I think they're just affirming what we've already put there, because we did the work team discussed voting threshold 2 and discussed whether a higher voting threshold should apply if staff would recommend against initiating a PDP, not related to the scope issue. Most agree that no higher voting threshold should be required, as it would otherwise give staff indirectly a vote in the process. And then it goes on a bit. So I presume they're just, you know, confirming with the work team's view on this issue.
Okay. The next comment relates to, which I thought we made recommendations, about how to handle competing working group charters. And I think we made some general statements about, you know, in general, it's really the council needs to grow, for lack of better words, they need to grow up and figure it out, that we can't dictate how the council handles it. Certainly by, you know, by requiring at that point a majority. We basically say the voting threshold for approving a charter is the same as approving the PDP. I believe that's what we said. Someone correct me if I'm wrong. And we discussed the issue of what if there's competing charters. And at that point it was, well, if competing charters both get approved, then it shouldn't be the first charter that gets approved is automatically the one that's used. That a vote should be taken on all of the charters. If both of them pass, then there should be some sort of way that the council mediates that and figures out which charter to go with. Otherwise, they don't move forward.
I'm not sure I understand the concept of approving a second charter without the approval indicating that it replaces the first.
Well, I just think that... I don't think you should automatically approve the first charter since if there are two charters that look like they'll meet the minimum threshold, which is certainly possible.
But
then
where are these charters coming from? I'm confused.
This is a working group charter.
Yeah.
Right? We said our recommendation was that the working group charter should be passed by the same vote that passes to initiate a PDP. And therefore,
right.
it is certainly possible to have two charters that meet that threshold.
If you were running two parallel universes, but in fact the council can only do one thing at a time, therefore I would think if there's a second charter that comes to light, it would have to be deemed to replace it and wouldn't be approved unless it was. And you could say you have dueling charters, you keep on flipping back and forth, I suppose.
Well, but you can't say that. Then the fight is to which charter is brought up first.
Well,
right? Then you're going to have a fight, and then do you vote on which charter comes up first? I don't think that's realistic, Alan. I think what you would say is if you have two charters, the chair is going to have to exert some sort of influence. That if you have two charters, two competing charters, and both look like they could meet the threshold just simply by discussions and other things that take place, at that point, the council needs to figure out, okay, maybe we need to have this sort of committee to figure out how we're going to merge these two. But it shouldn't, you know.
If I remember, the problem was because it's such a low charter, a low threshold to approve a PDP, if you had a higher threshold to approve the charter, you could have someone vetoing the charter, essentially, vetoing the PDP.
Correct.
By not allowing the charter to go ahead.
Right.
That was the rationale.
Right.
I guess, have we ever had a situation where there's competing charters?
The vertical integration. It worked out in the end, but with vertical integration PDP, you had, they weren't holistically different charters, but they were
right.
alternatives, right? And that was potentially a pretty big issue. Marika, do you have a comment?
Yeah, this is Marika. Just to point out what we actually put down in the report. So we basically said, like, in theory, it would be possible for competing charters to be adopted as only 33% of one house is required for adoption. The work team agreed that this issue needed further discussion on the list, as well as review of the pros and cons of possible solutions that were suggested, such as if there is more than one charter, it needs to be adopted by majority vote, allow the working group to decide on which charter, or the GNSO council chair to broker agreements. And hearing the discussion now, I wonder if this is one of the issues where we just say, look, that's, you know, for the GNSO council to work out at this time, and they might, you know, consider indeed adopting the majority vote rule or discussing it and working it out. Because I don't know either if we can set a, you know, black-white rule, because, you know, it might be difficult to foresee all the potential scenarios that could occur.
Well, you know what, but I do think, I don't want to push this to the council if we can come out with a recommendation here, because the council is just going to push it back, or I think if we can make a recommendation here, if we take a step back, we know that if there are competing charter provisions, those have to be presented at least 8 days or whatever it is before the vote that the council would have to take. At that point in time, do we recommend, if there are two charters submitted by the, or two charters, not even two full charters, but two provisions that conflict with each other, right? Because it may be just the alternative, you know, everyone agrees that in the charter two through six is the same, but number one, there are two alternatives. I think we should take a step back, and maybe not on this call, but we should recommend that if two charters or versions are presented by the deadline, at that point the chair should convene a or should ask for a committee of the two competing factions to meet to see if they can hammer out something, agree on one charter, and if not, then we need to think about that further. Aubrey, I'm sorry, you have a comment.
Okay. Yeah, I think we're making it too hard. I think asking them to do it before the vote is problematic, in that at that point each one will be expecting that theirs can win and the others can lose. So to get people into that kind of arbitration is difficult before both of them have succeeded. I think we can suggest a two-phase rule that says if more than one charter is approved by the council at this voting threshold, then first the chair tries to arbitrate between the separate, it doesn't have to be the chair, it could be the co-chairs, but or the vice chairs, try to arbitrate between the two to achieve one charter. If the chair decides that such arbitration cannot succeed, then a vote will be held of the various charters against each other, and the one with the greatest number wins. And, I mean, you know, obviously cleaner wording than that. And, you know, you vote between the two, you vote between the three, you vote between the four.
Right.
I absolutely see no problem with us recommending a two-stage. First, arbitrate. If you can't close the gap, then vote. And
so I think
the most wins.
I agree with what you said, Aubrey. I would just change the wording on the first part of it. Not that there's approval of both charters, but what you say is if there are more than one or competing charters that are presented by the deadline, you know, for that GNSO council meeting, a vote shall be taken on both of those charters. If both of those charters pass the threshold for needed, instead of saying approval, because Alan's kind of technically right.
Right, no, I am. That's, yeah.
So we mandate that a vote is taken on both of those. If both of those are above the charter for what would otherwise be approval, then there would be our mediation session. We won't dictate the procedures at this point of how that would be done. And then whichever one...
Priority.
The rest of what you said.
The only one I would comment on that is don't assume there's just two.
Right. If
there's more than one, all are put to a vote.
And plurality may not work with the bicameral system. You can have contracted versus non-contracted, as one may well have if this is a consensus policy issue.
Right. So I think Marika, you got that documented? In Alan's case,
what happens, therefore, since plurality can't win, he's right, what you have to do is majority wins, and if there are more than two, you go through that eliminating election process.
What do you mean by majority, Avery?
Majority of each house.
The genus of majority, the definition of majority there.
Oh, but then you...
Sorry, maybe I'm missing something. I don't see a majority.
If you're both between two things, one of them's going to get a majority.
Right.
If the two contracted party stakeholder group vote against something and the non-contracted parties vote for, each unanimous for argument's sake.
There is no charter. You're right.
It's equal.
We cannot solve that.
The PDP says let's cut all fees to contracted parties in half.
Well, that's out
or
of scope.
Or double them. I know it's out of scope, but I'm giving a ridiculous example.
So, guys, I need to...
Okay, we're over our hour.
Yeah, we're over the hour. I think at some point we need to just basically say to the council, you got to arbitrate that. You got to figure it out. But I think we've provided good solutions. I think the only issue we need to really address is transition, but that's an overarching issue anyway. So I think we're done with this public comment review tool, and I think we're good to adjourn until next week.
Yeah, I want to go back to this one, though, however, because I think there's an issue that we want to make sure that the issue of creating the charter does not, to use a gender-specific term, emasculate the PDP itself. And there's a distinct possibility of that if we're not careful. So I think we need to go back and talk about this more.
Okay. Do you want to submit? Can you submit an email on that?
I can try to remember to do that. Yep.
Okay. That would be great if we could get that moving. Great. Any other questions or comments? Thank you, everyone. We are now can say we are pretty much done with this public comment review tool. We just have to actually touch on some of Mary's comments that we didn't cover, and then we're good.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, everyone. All right. Bye.
Thanks, Jeff.
Yeah. Thanks.